Buongiorno everybody and welcome. Thank you for waking up at this awful, awful, awful hour to come here and listen to this Italian hippie tell you about what's new in Windows Identity Foundation in .NET Framework 4.5. My name is Vittorio Bertocci. I look after developer experience in the Windows Azure Active Directory team. And this brings me to my first question to this fine audience. How many of you, ladies and gentlemen, have Visual Studio installed on your machine? Excellent, thank you. Everybody else, I apologize in advance, but as you might have heard, the .NET framework is something that you use when you develop applications. So this session is going to kind of feature code, speak about classes, hierarchies, and similar. So if you are an administrator, you have my eternal gratitude. Thank you for doing this horrible job. No, not horrible, I don't like it, but you guys must love it. And I absolutely need you, so please don't stop. But this session would bore you to death. So if you're an administrator, I suggest you go back to sleep or to any other session that might make worthwhile your time. Okay, and that said, among everybody who lifted their hand, how many of you guys used Windows Identity Foundation 1.0? Okay, still a pretty significant percentage. So this session is going to be about the delta between what was in 1.0 and what was in 4.5. Now, since I knew, of course, that somebody would sneak in and would never used 1.0, I'll have a short introduction about what 1.0 is, also for doing some level set for everybody. However, most of these is going to be, in 1.0 it was X, now is Y. So once again, if you were expecting something different, there are 1, 2, 3, 4 doors. So it's really easy to get out of a room so that I don't waste your time. And I promise this is the end of the gotchas. Okay, so let's move to the agenda. And of course, being lazy, I didn't do it yet. So here is what I'd like to do. I'd like to give you a brief intro, then I'd like to tell you about the new object model and what are the most notable differences. Then I'd like to talk about the new SDK, which is a different package than the other one. And then I'd spend some time talking about Web SSO with Windows Azure Active Directory. How many of you attended the Stuart Kwan's session, when was it, 2 days ago, on Monday? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. So for everybody else, I strongly recommend that you check it out online because it was a very fine talk. And in that talk, Stuart showed how we are going to build this new directory in the cloud, and showed one demo of which demonstrated how you can take an arbitrary application and leverage the identities that you have in your Office 365 subscription to do single sign-on on your own app. So since that was especially interesting for people, I'm going to show you a bit behind the scenes. And now, in all these, I will sprinkle a bit of code here and there. So a bit here at the end, something in the middle. Of course, things will not line up completely, but you'll be forgiving. And here, I will give you a choice. I can do this Web SSO thing in the end, hence risk that we will not make it, or I can do it between the OM and the SDK. So how many of you wanted to see this thing just after the OM and before the SDK? 1, 2, 3, 4. Sorry, guys, you are in the minority. So it's going to be at the end. But I'll make sure to do it anyway, because otherwise people in Redmond will want my hair, and my wife wouldn't be happy about it. All right. Short introduction about what is Windows Identity Foundation. By now, we know what is claims-based identity, right? I will not ask you because I'm afraid of the answer. So I'll just assume that we all know what is claims-based identity. And the idea is very simple. You have a user somewhere. You have one application somewhere. You have a directory or a user store. in some way or another, and you have something which lives in front of your application, and whenever a user pops out a browser and tries to access the application and is not authenticated, this something will intercept the call, will decide what to do with it. Like, for example, it will forward the user to the authority where it's supposed to actually perform the authentication. And here, authentication will take place. Let's say that the user will send its own key and will get back a token. And then this token will be sent to the application. This something will examine the token, verify it's coming from the right place, right format, not being tampered with, and so on and so forth. And if happy about it, we'll establish a session by sending back a cookie. I never know how to do a cookie, so I do a pretzel. So that's how that normally works. But if you do this on .NET, since the last few years, you have been doing this with Windows Identity Foundation, which is substantially this block. Or if you are especially unlucky, this block as well. And what's inside of that thing? Normally, you don't need to know. You don't need to know because if you are following like the standard path, everything is figured out for you, and the default values are fine. However, there are times in which you are not fine with those defaults, and you want to tweak things around. So let's just take a quick look at what it means to have this block. Again, this is going to be super quick, but it's just for laying the foundation of the rest of the talk. OK. So first thing we said that we want, once we send this request, to intercept it and to forward the user to some authentication authority. This means that we are enforcing some kind of protocol. So we have here one HTTP module, which lives in front of your application, and in this case, enforces WS Federation. If you want to enforce another protocol, you use another module. Then you need to use some kind of currency here, like some kind of format, so that you can recognize that the user successfully authenticated and similar. So normally, you do use SAML tokens. And so here, there is a nice place where you can plug your token format analyzer, which we call a handler. And then after this, you might want to do something like you receive the account of a user and you want to enhance it with some local attributes. And then here we have another thing called the Claims Authentication Manager, which you can put in here in the pipeline to process it further. Once again, normally you don't need to know anything about this. I'm just showing you so that you know what's inside. And then this takes care of receiving and processing the token. But what about the session? Well, as it turns out, we need a bit more room here. There is another module which takes care of dealing with a session. So receives the stuff from the other module, creates the cookie, and in order to create the cookie here, you will have a session token handler, which is capable of processing your stuff. And then if you really, really wanted to go further and you want to do claims-based authorization, excellent. I forgot to put the claims authorization manager module. No problem. Let me draw it. Claim authorization module. Nothing happened. Don't tell my manager. Go away. And here there is this other class, which we call the Claims Authorization Manager, which can contain your custom logic to do interesting things like if a user is younger than a certain age, please do not show that page. So substantially, that's what you have inside that block that I drew earlier. And let's say that you have some, how to say, instead of using an off-the-shelf authority for your identities, you wanted to actually own the way in which tokens are issued, not just processed. Well, Windows Identity Foundation also has modules that act as a security token services, and also in this case, basically, you'd substantially have another block in here, and you get the point, right? This is what you get out of a box. This is, like Windows Identity Foundation is a toolkit. It's something that comes with a box with instructions, and if you follow the instructions, actually, you don't need to. You get the box and everything is already configured for you. But sometimes you might want to tweak things around. So let's say that you need to have a smaller token format for any reasons. Like, I don't know, perhaps your bandwidth is really, really limited. And so you can't afford someone. Well, that's pretty easy. You write your own little block, which supports another format like JOT. Then you get rid of the SAML one. Of course, now I have to deal with perspective. In my next life, I will do easier slide formats. Nobody forced me to do this. Remember, Vittorio? And here, at this point, I tweaked just a couple of things, and now I'm supporting a different token format instead of having to redo the entire thing. So super quick introduction for you guys for knowing what is Windows Identity Foundation, and for the ones who already knew, those are the things that we are dealing with. This is like the space of our options. That said, let's get back to Slideware. Windows Identity Foundation 1.0. We RTM'd it back in November 2009. That's the reason for a lot of white hair here and here. It was a lot of work at PDC, but it was fun. It was fun because it was a big leap forward. The standards, the protocols that we supported were there already for quite some time, but people had to actually write everything by hand from scratch every single time, including code for processing SAML, which is not exactly something you'd spend the weekend doing. So when we came out with this thing, we really gave a strong acceleration to the adoption of this approach of claims-based identity. The fact that SharePoint was taking a dependency on that helped. And that is also the reason for which we came out with that on .NET 3.5. More or less in the same time frame, we were coming out with a .NET 4.0, but SharePoint just had to come earlier than that. And it was dependent on 3.5, so we came out with it. And with mostly it was a runtime. If this is an MSU, so it's an update for the operating system, it is a runtime which contains a number of classes which substantially are the blocks that I've just shown. And developers could just add reference to that assembly, use those blocks, and have their application participate in the grand game of claims-based identity. Out of the box, we had support for AWS Federation, AWS Trust, and whatever else comes to mind if you want to write your own blog. We also added to this an SDK which helped administrators and developers to do some basic tasks associated with dealing with claims-based identity. So, for example, establishing trust. I have one application, I have one resource somewhere, one identity provider, and I needed to configure my application to trust that provider, redirecting there, and similar. Before this SDK, people had to type certificate thumbprints or long URIs, and God help you if you'd forget a trailing slash. Nothing would work, and you'd spend a couple of days finding out why. More white stuff. And instead, with this SDK, we substantially automated some of those steps. We'll see that this was far from perfect, but it was still a quantum leap. Okay, fast forward to the future, I guess, since we are still in RC. We didn't RTM yet. Windows Identity Foundation 4.5. Substantially, what we did was taking the classes that we had in 1.0, and we sprinkled them across the entire framework. So instead of being an out-of-band release, now this thing is actually part of a framework in itself. But it's actually not a just part. It is at the very core. In fact, most of the classes are in MS Core Lib. And as we'll see in a moment, this basically pervades everything identity in .NET. In a certain sense, you might say that there is no longer a WIF 4.5. This is a bit like buying a box of construction toys for like, I don't know, one spaceship, and you play with it a bit, and then you take all the individual bricks and input them back in this big box. And what happened to the spaceship? Does it still exist? Or is it like dissolved in the box? A bit of philosophy in 8:45. But I won't push it further, but I think it's an interesting idea. But in any case, basically the idea is that all these individual blocks that were before in one deliverable, like one out of band deliverable, are now part of a framework, And you'll use them in places where you would have never expected to use claims to begin with. But they are there. And I won't walk through those because I'll bore you with those later. And then we examined our SDK. We'll see again in a moment what that means. And we discovered that there were places where we could do it more friendly for developers. The former SDK was kind of like a stepping stone, like a ring of conjunction between administrator-only work, which was their province until we had WIF, and the developers using instead all these things. And now we completed our evolution, and our SDK is actually just for developers, which has pros and cons. So after all this blubbering, let me just show you a bit of code. Good. And my password is, you actually thought that I would tell. So here there's Visual Studio. Visual Studio, which is not going to be extremely snappy, so please, in the comments, write to my manager that I need a more powerful machine. Thank you. But I didn't want to start from an existing sample. I just wanted to give you the raw feeling of starting from scratch. So let me just come in here, make a new project. How many of you guys like MVC? How many of you guys can't live without WebFile? Somehow, I'm not surprised. So let's go with MVC. Also, 7 is a pretty good number. So now let's have our Visual Studio create all the various things, go back to their Nuget mothership and download all the various new nuggets and similar. And what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to run very quickly our new tools. I'm going to enable Windows Identity Foundation on this machine, which is kind of like a misnomer. Windows Identity Foundation is already enabled here. But let's just say that I'll do something for getting some interesting claims to play with. And then we'll just take a look at the effects. OK, here we have our default project. Let me zoom for your benefit. Let me right click in here. And among the various options, I have these new identity and access. Let me zoom out and zoom in. And here I have my tool, which in hopefully easy language explains what you can do with this. We'll go in painstakingly low details later, so let me just pick a test, hit OK, and that's it, I'm done. That's it, F5. And now IIS Express wakes up, it's early morning, in Redmond is still 5:48 a.m., so don't expect it to be super fast. You can see here this local STS. We'll see in a moment what that means. And slowly, our application comes up, hits the identity provider, comes back, and hey, as it turns out today, I am Terry. I didn't realize that waking up. And substantially here, we have our application. And let's say, I don't know, let's go to one controller. Let's go, for example, for the about. And let's say that instead of having this app description page, let's do something like your email is, and then claims principal. Don't you love this little thing in Visual Studio which gives you this capability? Claims principal dot current dot find first. We want the email, right? So claim types dot email dot value. All right. No red, shift control B. Excellent. Like even when you write trivial stuff, when you are in front of somebody, somehow the probability law gets bent toward you writing something really stupid and never realizing because, of course, everybody's looking at you. But for the time being, apparently, it seems to be working. OK, so let's just go to about and look at that. Hey, my email is terrycontoso.com. So it wasn't especially hard, and we don't know yet what happened, but it happened. I know, more philosophy. I apologize for that. Okay, so let's get back to this idea of WIF is now part of a framework. So when you develop with .NET and you need to access the identity of a current process or of a current caller, substantially what you're doing is you're getting something which implements the interface I principle. How many of you guys knew that already? Great, less than half, so I feel like I'm not wasting your time. Excellent. And the idea is that for every way out of a box in Windows in which you can authenticate, there is one concrete class which implements this interface, which somehow reflects the specific characteristics of that authentication method. So for example, in Windows Principle, you use the anti-rainbow table, you use the Kerberos, you have things that reflect that. Or in the role principle, you went through the membership provider, you have all your roles, and substantially the object model reflects that. Now, in WIF 1.0, we were out of band, and yet we had to participate to this party somehow. So how to participate to this thing? Well, we basically had to disguise ourselves as yet another I principle. So we didn't really provide a concrete, actually we did, but we didn't drive with a concrete implementation. We provided an interface which derived from my principle, we called it iClaims principle, and that star there represents the fact that we added their members containing claims and all the machinery necessary for doing claims. And so we played by the rules like everybody else. When you'd integrate with your application, we would substantially create an instance of that thing and then substitute it to the current principle. And that was nice, but it was also classic opportunity cost. Let's say that if I'm using a specific authentication type, then I don't use claims, and vice versa. So now that we had our chance to actually get in the 4.5, we did a pretty good trick, in my opinion. We derived, actually we implemented iPrinciple with another class, ClaimsPrinciple, which contains all the claims machinery. And then we went in pilgrimage to all the other product teams and saying, guys, how about you derive from our fantastic claims principle, look at all these nice claims that you get, and somehow we convinced them. And so now, all those guys derive from claims principle. As a result, whatever authentication system you use in Windows today, if you provided that you use .NET, that you want it or that you don't want it, you have claims in there. What does that mean? That means that if, for example, you use forms authentication, you get your role principle, you pull out from a membership provider, the current principle still has a collection claims which contains all the attributes that you pulled out from the roles in form of claims. So you learn one way of accessing those attributes, and that's the same independently of what you use for authenticating. I didn't see you very excited, but if you didn't know how much work it took for doing this, I'm sure that I'll chalk this down as it's early morning. Thank you. Look at me, reduced to beg for this. That's horrible. I'm really sinking low. And so that iClaims principle is now a thing of the past. It is no longer needed, so bye, it's gone. So it's good in general, but once you'll go and you'll migrate your existing 1.0 applications, which I encourage you to do as soon as we hit RTM, that's one of the things that you'll have to change. Let's say that now you have, you're doing, like we actually see some snippets of code, and all the things that you're doing today are no longer necessary. So you'll have to go comment out, delete, use whatever technique you want. Okay. This is what you had to do in 1.0 for pulling out claims. Let's say that you're in a classic page load, and you wanted to access the age of your user. And let's say that you have this custom claim type in that namespace. So first thing you had to grab the I principle from the current principle, pull it out, and cast it to claims principle. And of course, hope that whatever it was before your code did its job, and your principle is actually claims principle. Then after that, you had to differentiate to one of the claims identity that live in the identities collection in the principle, since the claims were accessible only per identity. So very rarely you would have more than one identity, but every single time you had to the reference. So you'd have to pull out this claims identity. And once you have that, you'd have to query this thing using a link, for example. Like, that was pretty much it. How many of you guys are familiar with a link syntax? Wow, it's 2012. I remember asking a couple of years ago, and like three people. Okay, excellent. So for you, it might not have been like a big obstacle, but still more carpal tunnel for typing it. And since we worry very, very much about your health, here there is the new way of doing the same thing in one single line, which is also like not a gimmick. It's not a single line because I'm cramming stuff in there. Is exactly the code which is natural to write. I have my claims principle. I have a static property, which is current, which substantially takes the current principle in the thread. From that, I have a number of utility methods which save me from having to write link when I'm doing easy queries. Like, for example, I just want the first claim, which is of an email type, and pull out the value. And there it is. So, not bad. I'm actually very happy with this. The other advantage is that since now it's a single line and similar, you can do these in line. Like if you wanted to go in your view in MVC, and you just wanted to open a razor hut and write down something, you can do that. Because with all that, it would have been kind of hard. With these, you just write that single line, and that's it. And of course, error management, I don't want to go there, but it's possible. So, summary, in WIF 1.0, we had a claims identity and draw link, and here you have the claims principle. Claims principle has one collection claims, which aggregates all the collections of the sub claims identities. So, apart from very special cases, you never have to see claims identity again. It's there, but you usually don't need to go there. Then we have this fantastic static property, which I really, really love, which makes it stupidly easy to access the correct claim, claim collection. Then we have a number of filters, like the classic, is there that type in the collection? Give me all of them, which you can use then for doing data binding, for example, and then just find the first one. And then, of course, as I mentioned, role providers. So now everything is a claim, regardless if it's coming from roles, so don't worry. And then we have these selectors, which is a bit advanced, so I'll just mention what it is. Sometimes you might not want that current property to give you the principle which is in the thread. Perhaps you are doing something custom and you have other principles somewhere else. And so at that point, you might want to override that behavior. And if you change the selector, you can do that. Or also in the context of a principle, for the rare cases in which you needed to get the current claims identity underlying, also there you might have a criteria for deciding to pick which identity. So if you override this selector, you can decide how this static property behaves. Well, little sidebar. Okay, namespace salad, so we are back to the... So what happened here is that we had on your left the old assembly, Microsoft identity model, and on the right we have three different assemblies. We have MS-Corlib, which is like home run for the people working on the framework. Like if you get stuff in there, then that means that you are somebody. And then there are other assemblies that, of course, have their dignity, but they are not at the same level as the MS-Corlib. And there are many more, actually. Both are the assemblies, but I'm not showing all the namespaces because we have quite a number. This is just a basic amount. So here I have all these various classes, and I'm about to move them around. But I need help from you guys. So I'll give you a hint. All those go in another namespace on the right side. And if you tell me the correct one, you'll get a fantastic book, which I found in the garage before coming back. That's true. I changed the car 1 year ago. I had those guys on the old car. It was in a big bug. And I started going through this bug and said, oh, wow, look at that, two books. And so I brought them for your enjoyment. So who can tell me in which namespace those guys are going? Yeah, I'm confused. I'll go with a gentleman with a red shirt because red is easier to spot. Hint for you guys that answered as well. Great. That's true. It goes on the first one. All those guys are now living in the deepest place you can think of in the framework. You said two? Oh, I'm very sorry. So, who's the next one? Who's wearing red? Ah, the lady. Okay. So you can pass it to the lady, where you'd maybe a favor. Thank you. I'm sorry, I almost robbed you of your fantastic victory. I apologize. Great. So you have another one, so you can give it another try. So let's say here we have all of these various modules that are substantially the things that implement the protocols. Like you can see how, in terms of abstraction level, the claims themselves and the module which implements a protocol live at a different level, because the claims are kind of like basics. Like this thing is one of the primitives that we are playing with. The protocols are kind of like transient. Well, anything that has a 10 years support policy cannot be called a transient, of course. But if you've been in IT for some time, you'll know that there was a CORBA, and there was a EBXML, and then SOAP came out, and then now there is OAuth and similar. So AWS Federation, which is one of the things implemented in there, is a very mature protocol, but nothing says that it is going to be the protocol forever. So of course, that thing doesn't live in a mescore lib, it lives somewhere else. Where does it live? You guys have to be assertive so I can look in your direction when you say two.
Two.
Okay, gentlemen with another red shirt. I clearly have a bias for colors. Et voila. Great. Also, come on, this one was easy because if you look just at the size, I didn't do it random. It just wouldn't fit on the other one. And here, inside in the middle, system identity model, we get all the things that are more, how to say, service level. So for example, token handlers, all the things that you use with WCF and similar. I've got to accelerate a bit here, otherwise we'll never make it. So this is just for giving you an idea and for preparing you for the next onslaught, which is configuration. Now, one interesting, and I say interesting in the Chinese sense, you know, the Chinese curse, may your life be interesting. It is a curse. The fact that we have now classes spread across different assemblies, which get loaded at different times, means that the nice, neat service configuration element which we had in 1.0 now cannot be one, because there are certain concepts that live in one assembly and others that live in another. So as a result, now all the elements that you see on your left side have to be mapped to two other elements here, which with not a lot of fantasy, we called identity configuration and federation configuration. So since I have no longer books, I cannot enlist you to help me. I'll have to do all the work myself. So here in the federation configuration, you take the AWS federation element, which is the one that contains references to the identity provider and to all, if you want to use SSL or not. So all the coordinates for specific for the protocol. And then the cookie handler. There is actually another element which I didn't add here, which is the server certificate. It is the part where you define what is going to be used for securing your service, so that if you need it somewhere else, you can use it. So here, but not shown. You know what? Let's just do it. See, and they say that PowerPoint is not flexible. It's very flexible. Then we have here the audience URI, which goes into the identity side. Then you have all the various claims, authorization, and authentication manager, which live here as well. The collection of token handlers live here as well. Application service, in my opinion, wasn't very useful in V1, and so it's gone now. It's one of the advantages of actually being in the product team. I spent like 4 years evangelizing these things, like just going around and talking about that. And then about 1 year ago, I moved in the product team. And so a lot of frustrations of things like that I really wanted to change. And in the last year, I could change. And you have no idea of the satisfaction. It's beautiful. We are hiring, by the way. And then the issue registry is also here. Again, there are many other classes here, but those are the main ones. So when you are migrating 1.0 to 4.5, you can refer to this slide. And most of the other elements that I'm not telling about here are sub-elements of those guys. So you just follow these, and you'll be fine. OK. Oops, no, this one. Don't look. Those are not the droids you were looking for. OK, Web Farm. How many of you ever tried to use Windows Identity Foundation in a server farm environment? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. OK, as those gentlemen, my witness, actually report, I'm sorry, my English early morning is not always in my English coprocessor has yet to warm up. They might attest the fact that it wasn't trivial. And now I'm going to show you a little schema of why it wasn't trivial. Say that you have your usual user, your usual browser. Here you have your application. And here you have your WIF. And you did your usual back and forth, and you got your cookie. Now, by default, Windows Identity Foundation secures the cookie. Of course, you've got to secure the cookie. Otherwise, the client will just make up whatever they want, like, yeah, I'm an emperor of the universe, get this claim, and trust it, of course. And instead, since the cookie is secured, they can't do that. It is secured by encrypting and signing it with one key, which lives on this machine. And this key comes from a DP API subsystem. It's like one crypto system in Windows. This key is specific for every machine. So let's say that now you are actually behind a balancer. Here, there's the balancer. Not the prettiest balancer you have ever seen. I acknowledge that. Here, there's another instance. And let's say that you have no affinity. So your next call goes to the other one. And you're sending this cookie secured with this key. But this is a different machine, and so it has a different key. And as a result, that cookie is unknown. So this user is not authenticated and will be forced for the authentication dance again. And now it will have a different cookie. And then once it will go to the other one, you'll do it again and again and again. Not nice. So the way in which we solved this in WIF 1.0 was to use our little custom bricks, in which substantially we would create a new token handler, substantially, and something that instead of using the DP API, which is the default, it would use the certificate that you are using anyway, because you want to do everything on SSL, for securing the cookie. Now, that was perfectly possible, because again, remember, bricks, I can exchange them and similar. However, it wasn't a walk in the park, because all of this part is for creating your new brick. And this part is for actually add the brick in the right place. And then you have to hook up this in the setup events. And then you have also to manage that certificate. Let's say that you've got to upload it, say to Windows Azure. You've got to give the right permissions. You have to put it in the config so that from this code, as you can see here, you can access that instead of strongly tying it around. So that's a lot of work. Let me delete all the stuff which is useless now. That's a lot of work. So in 4.5, we now have this other system, which of course I put in color so that you like it more. That's a subtle manipulation. I didn't do it on purpose. It's that pasting the other one, unfortunately, didn't conserve the colors, and I didn't have the time to redo everything. So what happens here is that out of the box, we have now a new security token handler, which is based on the machine key. The advantage of being based on the machine key is that you don't have to specify any coordinates. Like when you are using a certificate, I have to tell you which certificate I want, because there are many options. Whereas for the machine key, there is just one, if it's enabled. And here there is another advantage. In Windows Azure, all the instances that are part of the same hosted service have automatically their machine keys synchronized. As a result, if you are writing one application in .NET 4.5, when Windows Azure will support 4.5, or if you add 4.5 as a startup task, then you'll just be able to add this line of code in the config, no need to go in the global ASAX and similar, and you'll have support for web farms. In fact, this is so easy that we added a checkbox in our tools so that you don't even need to bother to do Control-C, Control-V. You just do the checkbox. Done. Very nice. All right. Windows 8 domains. Actually, I say Windows 8, I should have said a Windows Server 2012. Otherwise, marketing will want, again, my hair. But you understand what I mean when I say Windows 8 Server, right? If you have a Kerberos based on a Windows Server 2012 domain, you have a new feature such as the dynamic access. The dynamic access is something that can be used for doing things like determining who has access to a certain file share according to claims. So you can have a much, much richer policy. In order to implement some of these features, in the new Windows principle, which derives from claims principle, we added two special collections of claims that are user claims and device claims. Now, if in your domain installation you create specific attributes or for the current user or for the local machine, directly like in your Active Directory schema, now when you get your Windows principle, in those collections you will have those new attributes in form of claims. The result is that you can do interesting things like if you do some system which checks the health of the device on which the user is on, you might create rules that say if the user has a certain spending limit, claim from the user, and it's coming from a device that actually have an active antivirus, and this device has been connected to the domain in the last 7 days, then authenticate, otherwise authorize, otherwise send back. And that's pretty powerful, because the fact that we have those things, they make those claims at a much higher level of trust, because they come straight from Kerberos. It's not like something in the middle injected this thing in there. And again, this is the one feature that our administrator friends like. And then we have sprinkled a number of little improvements here and there, like for example, now in the token handlers, you can actually deserialize and serialize the tokens using strings. You might ask me, who cares? Well, let's say that the Windows Identity Foundation was conceived at a time in which the way of communicating was mostly angle brackets, so WS star, WS federation, and similar. Hence, all the token handlers have methods that are basically based on XML. However, as we move forward and we go more and more toward web, REST, auth, and similar, you'll see tokens that sometimes do not even look like tokens. Those are just like opaque strings and references and similar. So having to every time go through XML wasn't exactly handy, and so we added the constructors that can use strings. So probably not a big deal for most of you guys, but hey, in honor of the people that worked for adding that feature, I just have to say it. Then, how many of you guys use WCF? I might have miscalculated. I thought that like few people would have said yes instead. I'm very glad. Well, before, if you wanted to integrate WIF 1.0 in WCF, you had to actually change a factory. Like you actually had to change the way in which the service comes up. And now instead we have this nice use identity configuration, which is just a little flag in which if you check this flag, now everything will work, like the WIF pipeline will be automatically activated. And this is thanks to the fact that now the WIF classes live in the same namespace as the WCF classes. So now the integration is much easier. Then there was this flag called the easy session mode that you could use for using cookies but instead of pass claims by value, like every single time, they pass it by reference. So the system would put the actual deserialized claims in a cache, and then in the cookie it would just put a reference to that. And frankly, is session mode didn't make a lot of sense. I remember writing the chapter of a book in which I explained what that is, and I said, wait a minute. It's all a session, like also the normal cookie is a session. So why is session mode? And so we changed that to is reference mode. So not a huge change, but again, everything for clarity. And then, how many of you guys know what is a bootstrap token? One, two, three. Maybe we can get a fourth? No, okay, great. We feel alone here. The bootstrap token is substantially the first token that you get. Imagine that you are in a web application. You receive the token from the user that is actually behind the browser. That token is the token that started your session. And there are times in which you might want to use that token for propagating the identity of the user across different layers in your infrastructure. So you might be calling a backend, and you might want to take the identity that you got in there and flow it through. In order to do that, you take this first token, the bootstrap token, you present it to one STS and saying, hey, there is this user at this door, I am application X, please give me a delegated token for that user. Now, that thing was, as the name implies, a token. But now that we move the things around, like let's say that the token class is not yet available when we get in there. And so as a result, we had to call it a bootstrap context, and now it's like serialized as a blob. And then when you want to use that, you have to pull it out and cast it explicitly to token. Small price to pay for all the other goodness. Lots of other little things. Now, of course, every war has its victims, and here there is a sum. iClaim's principle and iClaim's identity are no longer necessary, and so they have been eliminated. Not a bad thing. Claim's principle HTTP module, we don't talk about that, but it's no longer there. I will not tell you why we don't talk about that. If you are curious, you can find me around and in front of a beer, I'll tell you. And then we had a number of bindings that were specific for ADFS. ADFS has a number of endpoints for WCF, and in order to call them, you need to craft a binding. And in WIF 1.0, we had those bindings out of the box. However, they weren't available by the configuration. You had to use the code anyway, and we observed that people just didn't use them all that much. And so more testing surface, gone. They are no longer there. So if you are using them, you need to create custom bindings that they will do the same. Again, if you are in that situation, come see me and I'll help you. And then there are a number of classes that before were public, and now that we had the opportunity of seeing how much they were used or not used, they became internal. So if you were doing some like magic, like reusing some of our key generation classes, for example, you might find that those classes are no longer available. But the good news is that there is still WIF 1.0, so if you need it, your reference with assembly, be careful with namespace collision, but you can still do that. Okay? All right. So now let's talk a bit about the SDK, our famous FedUtil. How many of you guys ever used the FedUtil in the past? Hey, look at that. Great. Excellent. Ah, yeah, this is the slide that for some reason it doesn't show. Let's do this again. See? It's easy. It's like my car in the morning. I lie. My car is awesome, but I will not tell you about it. Otherwise, you'll hate me more than you already do. So FedUtil was this utility which we came out with back in the day. Again, 2009 is when we RTM'd, but I started talking about these in 2007. Barcelona. So we are talking many years ago. And this thing is substantially something that, as I said earlier, you can run it against one application, and it will allow you to point this application to one authority, WS Federation Authority or WS Trust Authority, and it will spit out automatically the configuration for you. Hey, look at all that stuff. And configuration means adding the reference to WIF and adding the modules and saying the address of the identity provider, getting the thumbprint of the certificate that you need to use for checking the signatures, all things that administrators were used to do by hand at the time of ADFS 1.0. How many of you guys ever used ADFS 1.0? One, two, nobody else. Great. How is the post-traumatic disorder going? Well, I say that because, again, I don't know the first thing about administration, and that thing is like the cathedral for administrators. And it was just hard. Like, you had to go and read these documents and then type those arcane strings. And instead of now, everything happens now. Already 5 years ago, everything were happening automatically. So it was a huge step for administrators. It was such a huge step that it went all the way to developers, which developers could actually use this thing and start using federated identity without having a PhD in cryptography. Before that tool, it just was not possible. You had to churn bits by hand. And however, it was, how to say, still a bit midway. Like, yeah, it had legs, but still had to go back to the sea from time to time to breathe some water. Because substantially, it asked you to know a lot about those protocols. It asked you to be familiar with this idea of a federation. Actually, if you'd have to just do the basic thing, like exactly follow the basic steps, like a tightrope, you just don't look, and you stay on the path, everything would work. But as soon as you'd like to change a little thing, as soon as your application or a scenario required some little change, you'd fall from a very high place. And you had to be knowledgeable about all this. So good could be better. So what we did was taking this thing and starting to analyze it and understand from the point of view of a developer what it would mean to do it. And now, I will not bore you with the details, but we did something like, OK, entry point is add STS reference. If I'm a normal developer, what is an STS again, and why would I want to reference it? And then when you get in there and it asks you, this is which config file do you want to use? Well, I'm coming from Visual Studio. You know which config you want me to use. And then it would all go on and say, hey, you're not using HTTPS. Of course, I'm on my local box. Why would I use HTTPS? Which, again, here you can see the dichotomy between the administrator and the developer. The developer will say, yeah, yeah, of course. The administrator will say, ah, no HTTPS, are you crazy? And then, of course, like at the time, we were trying to do for both, and so we had to do these compromises. And then after that, we'd give you some options saying you have no STS, or you create an STS in your local project, or reference an external STS. And again, this STS thing, what is it, and what does it mean to create one, to create the other? And also, it would create a project in your current solution, which was not always clear what would happen. Like, if you'd look at SharePoint development, which was our main target at the time, people would just create a website, not a web project, a website, and just go with it, and typically target IIS and similar. But as soon as you'd take this thing and, for example, move it on Windows Azure, what does it mean to create a new project? Like, is it something that I'm going to deploy in Windows Azure? Am I going to be charged for that? Like, it was just a bit out of, like, again, for administrators, in that specific context, business apps on websites, great. Less great for the generic developer. And then like we had this summary in which we would tell people, this is what we are going to do. And if you would not have spent time learning about AWS Federation, then you would have no idea what that thing is saying. And then it would, well, little dialogue, never mind. And then the result would actually be this thing in which you'd have an extra project in your system. And this extra project would be your STS. But then now you'd have to learn how to use it. Like if you wanted to experiment, like get custom claims and similar, then now you'd have a problem of how do I do that? And you'd actually have to go and modify stuff, which of course, not easy. So here we went ahead and redesigned the entire thing from scratch, saying, okay, we are going to focus on developers. Administrators, sorry, you'll get this, like you already know about these, so you don't necessarily need the Rails, but for developers that might not have domain-specific knowledge, you have to use something like that. And so we tried to create a language that was as simple as possible. Of course, there is a limit to how simple. Like, we are still talking about high abstraction levels, so we can't make it like stupidly easy. But we can certainly make it easier, and the hope is that we did that. You guys tell us if we succeeded. And then we tried to reduce as much as possible the clicks. We tried to make sensible assumptions, as in what are the defaults that make sense, in order to reduce everything. And then also we are in 2012, so instead of an MSI, we have a Visual Studio extension, so that when we update it, you get the little dialogue, hey, there is a new version, so that we can fix bugs before you find them, hopefully. And also, like, we added test STSs and similar. And we integrate with the Windows Azure Control Service. So earlier, you have seen that I used, I just clicked on my use a test STS, and I got claims. How did that happen? Let's take a quick look. Now, in the new tools, I have three tabs. Actually, let's just take a quick look in general to the options. Here, I have three options. I can use a local STS. Yes, I know. I'm still using STS, which is bad. But on the other hand, I say, what is it used for? For testing your application. So even if you don't know what that is, perhaps it's a good option. And then you click on that, and you have to do nothing else. We have seen how it works. And we look at the other one in a moment. And here we have one extra tab, the local development STS, which allows me to define what are the claims that I want to receive for my application, so that I can just put test values in here. I can use my custom systems. All these settings have a UI, but they also end up in one separate configuration. So that if you have test cases, you can have multiple copies of this configuration, and when you run the test, you just substitute the file, and that's it. Or if you have a problem and you needed to send something to support, you get your repo, and you send it to support, and that's easy, you're there. And this thing runs every time I hit F5, and as one little local project in my system tray, today that's what requires us to run as administrator. We are looking if before RTM we can relax that condition. How many of you would not use this tool if it requires running Visual Studio as an admin? One, two, three. How many of you would not use this tool if it forces you to run Visual Studio as an administrator? One, two, three. Okay, three, sorry. We are trying to fix it, but I have to be honest, I'm relieved that it's free and not everybody. Great. So let me switch back quickly. Okay. Then, connecting to ADFS. Connecting to ADFS was a long process in which you got a lot of warnings and similar, and now instead it is pretty straightforward. Very straightforward. And substantially what happens is that we take a lot of decisions on your behalf. Those decisions are pretty, loose, because we assume a dev box. You've got to harden this thing before deploying it. And so, for example, here, I don't have an ADFS available, which is why we created the local STS, by the way, but just for showing you how it, just for showing you what it looks like, when I choose a business identity provider, it asks me where to find the metadata document, and that's it, nothing else. Well, of course, I have to say what is the realm of my application, but that's it. I hit OK, and I'm done. And instead, in the other one, you had to go through, I don't remember the exact number, but it's between 7 and 8 steps, in which you would also ask you, do you want to encrypt and similar. So here, we significantly simplify the things. OK, we are back. Then, the other thing about FedUtil is that it was a fire and forget, but not in the good sense. It was actually like a wizard which would run in almost full independence from what was in your application already. Like, you couldn't use it for example, tweaking things here and there. You had to start from scratch. And instead, now we have memory. Let's say that every time that you come to this identity and access tool, let me zoom so that you guys don't have to squint and get early age lines, which are always bad. Here, if I go on the configuration tab, you'll see that I'm reading directly from the config what are my settings, what my settings are. And those are things that I would often want to change. Like, for example, if I take my application, I test it on my local, like smoke test on my dev environment, and then I have to deploy it to Windows Azure, I will have to change some of these things because my URI will change, will be listening to some other place. So here, I just change it from here. I don't have to go to my config file. Or many web developers are not crazy about the blanket redirect, which we do. Like, for example, if you are on the internet and you do your redirect, normally the user doesn't see anything because the authentication happens automatically. You are on the internet, Kerberos will take care of that. But if you are on the web, usually you write the address of your app, and what you see instead of the app is the STS UI or the choice for the STSs. It doesn't fly too much. And so here we have this redirect the following address, which allow you to configure your application to, instead of doing that, to actually go back to forms.auth. And then you go to forms.auth and you can modify it to host the forward to the STS, for example. But you still have some control over the experience. And then here we have something like, okay, you want to harden things, go ahead, require HTTPS. And the farm cookies that I mentioned earlier. Just a little checkbox, and you are farm ready. Pretty awesome. Okay. Back to the other computer. And this one is one of my favorite. Actually, why do I keep going back and forth? I could just stay on Visual Studio. I'm sorry, if you have motion sickness, I apologize. So let's go back to our tools. And now let's take a look at what happens when I say use the Windows Azure Access Control Service. I already configured this application, this tool, to use a namespace, which is my development namespace. And what happens when I say use ACS is that the tool reaches out to ACS, reads the list of all the possible identity providers that I have in there. And of course, if I would have added the ADFS, it would be there as well. And then at this point, let me zoom out. And if I select the one that I want and I hit OK, what will happen if the internet assists us, and apparently it did, is that the system will reach out for ACS, create an entry for my local application, create various rules for just copying everything in the through claim, and then configure my local app to go through ACS. And now I get automatically my list. Let's sign in with Facebook. Hey! Spontaneous applause. I am touched. Thank you. Thank you. Had I known, I would have done this earlier. And look at that. I'm no longer Terry. I feel better now. I am Vittorio Bertocci. And the big change in here is like this thing does not substitute the ACS portal. If you want to manage your identity providers, you still got to go in there, and you got to change things. But this thing removes for the developer, for the generic developer, let's say, the need to understand that ACS is only a resource STS, that it is an intermediary, and your federation relationship is with that. But then it will have its own on-prem discovery page, and you have to go in there, and you have to provision your application and understand what the flow is. Like, all that stuff is now hidden from this simple list of checkboxes. Again, complexity doesn't go away, it just gets hidden. If you walk out of a path, you've got to go back and learn all that stuff. But at least for like the 80-20 case, if you just wanted to test this dumb thing, you don't have to get a PhD, which is kind of nice. So, back to two, okay. Yep, and the other advantage is that I might give to my developers access just to the development namespace because I give them the key for this namespace. So even if they don't have access to my Windows Azure subscription, they can still work. Like, they don't need to have actually the live ID that you are using for administering your thing. So again, if you are, like, for example, outsourcing work, you don't need to hand out the key of the castle to external people, which is not that bad. Yeah, sidebar, I'm not sure if I have the time, but you know what? I'll go for it. So here, basically, I'm saying what I said earlier, in which developers do not always want to have this blanket redirect. Sometimes they want to have some control over it. Now, I was considering coding this live, but we don't have time. And I will not hide that I'm kind of relieved that we don't have time. So I can show you something that you can actually do also with 1.0. You don't need it to use for 5, but it's still nice, so I'm showing it anyway. And that's a way in which you can use the new tools for changing the way in which you deal with the redirects. And then you can change a couple of things in your MVC app so that you can host the HomeRAM discovery experience instead of having to go all the way to ACS. So you still have the illusion of control. I'm joking, it's actually control. So if I go back on the tools and I go on the tab here, you can see that I am configured to redirect unauthenticated things to my account login. So this is exactly like the default MVC. Hey, I want to come out of this. I managed. Moment of panic. And then once I do that, I can go in my controller. Actually, I don't need to do anything because the controller is just showing the view. So what I need to do is actually go in the view. So let's go in my view for login. And all I did in here was substitute the div. And here, I apologize for the people that are not familiar with MVC, but I've seen that most of you raised their hand. So I took the login view, I substituted the div which shows username, password, and similar, and I added an empty div. And then I just added one script, which for unobtrusive I'll show you in a moment, and I am executing a script which is offered by ACS, in which they return the list of identity providers and then pass it to one callback that I define. And the callback, you guessed it, is one JavaScript method which I defined in my other script. And so let's see what it does. Thanks to the power of jQuery, which never ceases to amaze me, basically what's happening is that here I'm getting from ACS, from that call, the list of identity providers. And then I'm just parsing that list, and for every entry, creating a link which has the name of identity provider and points to the login address that I got from ACS. So now at that point, if I just hit F5 and hope that nothing changed from when we started the session. Now, the expectation is that I don't get redirected, but when I land on my homepage, I just see my homepage like if nothing happened. And now I think that, was it about? In one of the controllers, I added one authorize, yes, in the about. As you can see here, I just added an authorize, nothing with specific. And then if I go for the about, now is when the authentication happens. And as you can see here, instead of being redirected, I own the user experience. And like, so I could use my fantastic Italian design to give you this dazzling UI. But you see my point. Like, if I want to customize it for part of my thing, I can certainly do it. Red, excellent, absolutely. Scott Guthrie would be happy about it. He likes red. And so here, as you can see, I took some control of my experience. So great. So I have a few minutes left, and I really have to show you. Well, I have to mention the new samples. New samples are completely redesigned. Bigger red means more details, more hopefully useful, because they show more common tasks as opposed to the 1.0. and a lot of comments in the code. So hopefully you'll find them more useful. And you find them directly from Visual Studio. If you want to use one sample, you just go in the extensions, you search for claims, you'll find them, and then don't search for them in the file system. Just make a new project, go under samples, pick web, and they are all there. Okay, so here we needed to do, again, the trick. So here, let's say that the reason for which I'm showing you these is that it's a good way of putting pretty much everything together. And now let me save time by opening the project as I talk. Like, the purpose of what we are doing here is to get in your own application to authenticate with Office 365. Yes, I am aware. So that you don't see the dirty things that I'm doing right now. No, not really. So, and the purpose of this is I want to get my own application to authenticate with Office 365. And so I have my user, and here there is Office 365 is here. Actually, this is one directory in Windows Azure Active Directory, which gets created for Office 365. So a customer that bought that and wants to get access to your application will have to substantially create a principal for your application in their own directory. And so what happens is that you'll give them a script, and this is just a preview. Later we'll have a better way of doing this, but for the time being, you just give them a script. They'll run this script on their own directory, and this thing will create one entry for their for your own application. And then your application will have the usual federation module, we'll use SAML, and substantially what happens is that you'll have ACS, which has one STS entry specifically for Office 365. You'll connect to that, and you'll just go federation as usual. Well, almost as usual, because the tokens that you get from Office 365 are of this format. Instead of giving as audience URI the realm of your application, they use this format in which there is the ID of your application, but it's followed by the ID of a tenant of your customer. So in other words, every time you get a token from a specific customer, the realm of your application contains also indication about the customer, so that you can say, yes, this guy actually paid this month, so I'm going to give him access. So that means that you can't just use our tools for automatically configuring this guy, but you have to actually find out the ID of a tenant that bought your app and go and modify a little thing in your config. So not that hard. And that's the basic flow. Then there is another variation of this flow in which if you have another customer which buys your application, so they also create the same ID, then at that point, they will be sending you a token of this format in which the principal ID is still your application, but the tenant is a different tenant. And now by default, in a WIF, you can deal with that by changing the list of audience URIs. But if you change the list of audience URIs in your web config, IIS is going to sense that something changed and is going to recycle the process, which if you want to give continuity of service, that's not the best. So one solution that we have right now, and I remind you, Windows Azure Active Directory is currently in a developer preview, is to just customize the way in which we secure SAML tokens. So now here you have like one little custom brick, which for some reason is bigger than the others. So let's make it smaller. And this thing, instead of looking at your config, it will look at an external list of files so that you can keep adding people. The more they buy, the more you add them. And you don't need to modify your web config. So this is a nice way of seeing how this works. If you look at this example, which we'll release in a few weeks, you can see that I commented out some of the things that were coming from 1.0, and we can go into the details later if you want. This afternoon, I'll show up in the booth. And substantially what happens here is that I'm putting together most of the things that I said during the talk. I have my MVC app, which of course is using a fake certificate. Because hey, I'm poor, I can't buy a new one. And here we automatically generate the UI using the same principle that I described earlier, not from ACS, but from the list of customers. And here, as you can see, we are going through Office 365. This will change. It will say Windows Azure Active Directory. Let's see if I remember the password. For some kind of miracle, I think I did. And then here you just get your list of identity providers. So if you wanted to sell stuff to an Office 365 subscribers, you can do it. It's easy. Okay. So super quick summary, since we are almost out of time. Windows Identity Foundation is now part on 4.5, which is pretty awesome. It allows us to have a claims principle all over the place. We have a new object model, which is much easier to use. We have a new SDK, which is specifically for developers. And if you walk out of this with just one message, is think of WIF as your toolkit for when you want to do anything identity related. That's what will make your life easier. That's what will give you the correct blocks for modifying things. And so now that you know all about these, what are you waiting for? Thank you. Thank you. So if, I don't believe it, but if you really still want to hear about this stuff, just after lunch, I'll be at the booth. You recognize me, I belong here. So feel free to stop by and ask me, and I'll give you a headache about this.